Hey, so dragons, beasts, battles. What are we to make of these images in the book of Revelation? What is John the Revelator trying to tell us about what he is seeing, and what are we supposed to think? If you're like me, maybe you've read the book of Revelation a few times in your life, and you've been going through it and just wondering, what on earth is going on here? These images are wild and crazy and out there and hard to understand, and sometimes they're majestic and beautiful, and sometimes they're violent and scary. What is going on in the book of Revelation? Now, I mentioned to you a few weeks ago that in the news there was yet another so-called prophet who was reading the book of Revelation and was reading Revelation 12, which is where we're starting today. And he did his calculations and he put all the signs together and he declared with confidence that the world was going to end on September 23rd. Now, in case you haven't realized it yet, it didn't end on September 23rd. And then after that happened, I made a prophecy. I prophesied through the very spiritual medium of Twitter that this so-called prophet would reread and recalculate and set a date further in the future. And I was right. My prophecy came true, but I didn't make the news, unfortunately. I'm not famous. But this happens all the time in the book of Revelation. Revelation is one of those books that attracts the press. It attracts wild and outlandish theories. And everybody wants to be the prophet who predicts the end of the world, or at least to get a book deal about it in the meantime. Now, G.K. Chesterton once commented on this issue, and he said, "Though St. John the Evangelist saw many strange monsters in his vision, he saw no creature so wild as one of his own commentators." Right? So if we think the book of Revelation is wild at times, sometimes it's the people who are writing about it who get really wild. So our plan is to do a collection of mini-series in the book of Revelation that's going to take us a few years, because we're going to do kind of like 4 to 8 weeks at a time, and we'll do a couple of those every year until we're done. And our goal is not to become one of the wild creature commentators that G.K. Chesterton was talking about and being obsessed with the end of the world. There will certainly be some discussion about those themes as we get to them. But the overall emphasis of the book of Revelation is not the end of the world. The overall emphasis of the book of Revelation is how to be a follower of Jesus right now. How to be an overcomer today. How to be faithful to the gospel in our present moment, no matter what is going on. The visions that St. John the Revelator shared with his original audience were not meant to spur them on towards speculation about the end times. They were meant to spur them on toward greater measures of faith in times of trouble and tribulation. Daryl Johnson said this. He said, "Revelation is not a crystal ball revealing esoteric secrets that enable one to escape the harsh realities of life on earth, but a down-to-earth manual on how to be a disciple of Jesus facing the harsh realities of earth." It's not a crystal ball. It's a discipleship manual. Sometimes the reason why we're always obsessed with the end times is because we want to get out of here. We want to leave this place. We want to escape. But Jesus is saying, no, you're here for a reason. And Paul and John is saying through these visions, this is the reason you're here, and this is how you can endure the trouble and trial you are facing until Jesus returns. And this makes sense because John, who wrote the book, he was a pastor first and foremost. Sure, he was a prophet. Sure, he was an apocalyptic seer. Sure, all those things. But first and foremost, John was a pastor. He was the closest friend of Jesus. He was well advanced in years by this time. He had pastored and loved many people. If you read his letters, you read the theme of love. He's trying to love people. And as a pastor, he is trying to encourage and build up the churches in Rome who are facing persecution. And that's the real context of the book of Revelation. It was a difficult time in the history of the church to be a Christian. John is writing to Christians throughout the Roman Empire in the early 90s AD. It was a season where there was a lot of persecution happening. It broke out under Emperor Nero in 65 AD, and he was known to light his garden with burning Christians. That's one of the things that he did. It intensified under Emperor Vespasian in 67 BC. This is about the time where Peter was martyred. And then in the years and decades to come, you see Paul is martyred, Timothy is martyred, other leaders in the church are killed for preaching about Jesus. In AD 70, Jerusalem was destroyed, and that's really where Christianity began. So there's lots of Christians that suffered through that time. And then in AD 92, Emperor Domitian came into power. Domitian was a very insecure man, and he ordered that every Roman citizen or every subject of Rome would worship him as Lord and God. He actually built special temples in his honor, and you would have to go to that temple and take a pinch of incense and throw it in the fire and say, Caesar Kyrios, which means Caesar is Lord. Now, this was a very difficult thing for Christians to do, because the first statement of faith for Christians was Jesus is Lord. So they can't say Caesar is Lord, because if they say Caesar is Lord, that means Caesar is more important than Jesus in their life. But Jesus is my leader. Jesus is my God. Jesus is in charge of my life. Jesus says how I live, not Caesar. So I can't go and say Caesar is Lord. And so when Christians refused to do this, they were persecuted. Now, the Roman tactic wasn't necessarily that they would go after every single Christian and your average everyday churchgoer. They would specifically go after leaders. And so when John refused to say Caesar Kyrios, he was persecuted, he was attacked, he was arrested, and he was exiled to an island called Patmos, which is off the coast of Turkey, and it was a prison colony, it was a quarry. He was about 80 or 90 years old around this time, and he was sent into forced labor. But it was in this place, when he was worshiping, that he began to have these visions that he wrote down and shared with God's people. So here's the question Revelation is not trying to answer. When is the world going to end and how is it going to happen? That's not the point of the book. Here's the question Revelation is trying to answer. If Jesus is Lord, why are times so tough? If Jesus really did achieve victory on the cross, why am I suffering? Why are Christians being persecuted? Why is there still sickness in the world? Why is there still pain? If Jesus is Lord, why does Caesar have so much power? What is going on? And it's been decades now of this. When is he coming back? Why hasn't he returned yet? And so John, the pastor, is trying to encourage and build up the church and strengthen them so they don't get discouraged as they go through persecution. So there's more to say, and we will say more about the context and the genre of this literature, but let's just start reading in Revelation chapter 12. You'll notice we're starting in the middle of the book. And the reason is, well, partly Revelation isn't really in chronological order, most of it, and so that's not as big a deal. But Revelation 12 is kind of like a hub in the wheel. It's a theological center. And to be honest, it's just a really interesting section that I think will be a great start for us in this series, and it's very relevant to today. So we're going to start in Revelation chapter 12, verses 1 to 12. John writes what he saw. He said, "A great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and a crown of 12 stars on her head. She was pregnant and cried out in pain as she was about to give birth. Then another sign appeared in heaven, an enormous red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 crowns on its heads. Its tail swept a third of the stars out of the sky and flung them to the earth. The dragon stood in front of the woman who was about to give birth so that it might devour her child the moment it was born. She gave birth to a son, a male child, who will rule all the nations with an iron scepter. And her child was snatched up to God and to his throne. The woman fled into the wilderness to a place prepared for her by God, where she might be taken care of for 1,260 days. Then war broke out in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought back. But he was not strong enough, and they lost their place in heaven. The great dragon was hurled down, that ancient serpent called the devil or Satan, who leads the whole world astray. He was hurled to the earth, and his angels with him. Then I heard a loud voice in heaven say, 'Now have come the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Messiah. For the accuser of our brothers and sisters, who accuses them before our God day and night, has been hurled down. They triumphed over him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony. They did not love their lives so much as to shrink from death. Therefore rejoice, you heavens, and you who dwell in them. But woe to the earth and the sea, because the devil has gone down to you. He is filled with fury because he knows his time is short. Wow. It's an incredible scene. A woman, a dragon with seven heads, a baby born, a cosmic battle in the heavens. What is Revelation trying to do here? What are these visions trying to accomplish? Well, they are trying to reignite our imagination to see biblical truths in a fresh way. And they are also trying to reveal to us hidden spiritual realities that aren't immediately apparent in the physical world. One of the things we'll discover through this series is that Revelation does not really tend to add new information from the rest of the Bible. It really retells and re-envisions biblical truth in a fresh way and helps open a door, open a window to the spiritual world to enable us to see through and see what's going on underneath the surface. For example, maybe you saw it as I was reading that passage, that this story actually is a retelling of the Christmas story, right? There's a woman in labor pains, and there is a baby being born, and then there is someone who tries to kill the baby, but the baby is snatched away to a place of safety. Well, of course, we read in the Gospels the nativity story of Mary giving birth to Jesus, and King Herod wanting to kill baby Jesus. But Joseph, Jesus' adoptive father, is warned in a dream to hide the baby, and they go down to Egypt to hide out until they can come back after Herod is gone. It's a retelling of the Christmas story. Now, this is a story, this dragon and this woman standing on the moon, this isn't immediately apparent in the nativity story when you read the Gospels, but that's what Revelation is trying to do. It's trying to pull back the curtain to say things are not as they seem. There is a hidden spiritual reality that you may not be immediately aware of. In fact, the original title of the book is The Apocalypse of Jesus Christ. Our modern culture has appropriated that word apocalypse to mean the end of the world. Global warming, a meteor smashes into us, nuclear warfare, some sort of apocalyptic cataclysmic event. But apocalypse original meaning means unveiling. That's the title of our series, Unveiled. It means revealing, revelation. That's what the word apocalypse means. It's like taking a blanket off of an item that you've been hiding and people can see what it is. And so what these visions are doing is they're opening up windows into the spiritual world for us to see what is going on behind the scenes. So let's look a little bit more at this scene. There's three main characters that it describes. First of all, we see that there is the woman. Verse 1 says, a great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and a crown of 12 stars on her head. She was pregnant and cried out in pain as she was about to give birth. Now, for John to say a sign appeared, what's he doing there is he's saying, this is something that represents something else. This sign points to a greater reality beyond itself. This is not the thing in itself, it's pointing to something else. And so that gets us thinking, okay, where have we seen these images before? Because Revelation, like I said, is drawing other themes out of the scriptures. And so we want to figure out what this sign is pointing to. So another time where we find a vision of a sun and a moon and 12 stars is in Genesis chapter 37. Joseph has one of his dreams. And in the dream, he sees the sun and the moon, and he sees 11 stars bowing down to him, the 12th star. So what we see at this sign, the first image that we're supposed to be thinking of is the nation of Israel. Joseph's family, his parents represented patriarchs of Israel. His brothers represented the 12 tribes of Israel. So as we see this woman with the sun and the moon and the 12 stars, we see Israel represented in this sign. But secondly, and more specifically, we bring that down and we see Mary, Jesus' mother, represented in this sign. In the book of Luke, the Gospel of Luke, Mary is very deliberately portrayed as the faithful remnant of Israel represented in one woman. So here's Israel in Mary being represented here, giving birth to the Messiah. The Messiah came out of the nation of Israel, but specifically one Israelite woman, Mary, who brought him forth. Additionally, we can see the church represented in this sign. Verse 17 talks about the offspring of the woman, and the church is represented there, all those faithful followers of Jesus from this time onward. Second character, the dragon. Verse 3 says, another sign appeared in heaven, an enormous dragon. So again, a sign. Verse 9, John tells us what this sign points to. He says it symbolizes Satan, the devil, the accuser, the slanderer, the betrayer. The dragon image would have conjured pictures in the minds of the first hearers, both of contemporary pagan mythology as well as Old Testament imagery. They would have thought of the serpent in the Garden of Eden. They would have thought of the Old Testament beasts of Leviathan and Behemoth and the way those beasts of chaos were thrown down by the Lord. So it says he's red, the color of blood. He has seven heads. Seven is the number of completeness. A head represents authority, so he has complete authority. He has 10 horns. Horns represent strength. So he's immensely strong. He has 7 crowns on his head, representing his wealth and his power. His influence is represented by his ability to sweep a third of the stars from the sky with his tail, commonly believed to be maybe the percentage of angels that he deceived to form his rebellion against God. Thirdly, there is the sun. The woman gave birth to a son, and he would rule with an iron scepter. This idea of him ruling with an iron scepter is a throwback to Psalm 2, which was generally believed to be a messianic psalm that predicted the coming of the Messiah, the ruler of the nations. So this son is that Messiah. This son is that promised ruler that would come. Now notice, John said there was a sign of a woman, and then there was a sign of a dragon, and then he said there was a son. The son was not a sign. Like the woman and the dragon. The sun is not pointing to a greater reality. The sun is the reality itself. This is the great reality that we are seeing. He is all that truly is real. He's not pointing to anything else. This truly is the Messiah. We're not looking for a literal woman clothed in the sun, standing on the moon with a crown of 12 stars on her head. We're not looking for a literal dragon with 7 heads, but we are looking for a literal baby. We are looking for a literal son because Jesus is real. Jesus is a real historical person who was born into the world to rule the nations with an iron scepter. He is the Messiah. He is the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, and he has come. John says this isn't just a sign. This is the reality that has come to us. But look out. Verse 4, the dragon stood in front of the woman who was about to give birth, so that it might devour her child the moment he was born. As I told you earlier, this passage is seen as a retelling of the nativity story. Jesus was born into the world, but the puppet king of the Jews, Herod, was jealous, and he'd heard the prophecy that this son would be the real king of the Jews, and so he tried to kill him. And in fact, he killed all the baby boys around his age at the time, but he was able to escape. So what we see here is that the dragon is personified in a real historical character, right? And what we'll notice through the whole book of Revelation is the dragon, the beasts, images like Babylon. We're not necessarily looking for just one person or place or thing that's going to fulfill this, but we see throughout history that over and over again, the dragon is always at work, the beasts are always beastly, Babylon rises and forms itself in many different ways, and we must always be prepared to deal with these challenges to our faith. But imagine this Christmas in your living room, under your tree, outside of the church, or in a public place, you see a nativity set. And instead of shepherds and sheep and donkeys, there's a big dragon trying to eat a baby. What a cute, beautiful little neat. This is what we're seeing, is this wasn't just a cute little scene. Behind this scene of, and normally it's just the men who think it's a cute little scene, because the women probably believe, you know, giving birth in a stable was not a cute little scene, right? So it's not this cute little nativity, clean little sterile nativity set. There is a cosmic war going on in the background. There is a dragon trying to devour this child, sweeping angels out of the sky, causing battle against God, all to stop this child from coming into the world, but he could not. He is a cosmic failure time and time again, because God is always the victor. The baby was snatched away. This is a summary statement of Jesus' life. First of all, we see that he was snatched away from Herod, who personified the dragon at this time. But it also says he was snatched up to the throne of God, which means the dragon tried again on the cross to destroy Jesus once and for all. But Jesus rose from the dead, and he ascended to heaven into the throne room of God. So he was snatched up to God, and once again the dragon failed to devour him. So he got mad and started a fight. Verse 7 and 8, we see, then war broke out in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought back, but he was not strong enough, and they lost their place in heaven. This is the war. This is the war. This is the cosmic war, the war behind every war. Every war, every act of violence and dissension and discord starts from this place. Everything we see that tears people apart and brings hate and evil into the world begins here and is inspired by this war. But John announces the good news at least five different times from verse 9 to verse 13. He says, the dragon has been hurled down. Amen? The dragon has been hurled down. Literally in the Greek, it means he's been bounced. Right? Michael, the bouncer of Club Heaven, dealt with the seven-headed dragon. Right? That's what's happened. He's been bounced out of heaven. There's been a great victory. Jesus says in Luke 10, 18 to 20, I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven. What a weird thing for Jesus to say. If you were with him, you'd have said, where were you when this happened? And Jesus is once again claiming there's more going on than you realize, even with me. I have seen things that you cannot comprehend, because I am God in the flesh, and I have actually seen Satan bounced from heaven. But he says this, however, do not rejoice that the spirits submit to you, but rejoice that your names are written in heaven. We're not supposed to be all glad that Satan is defeated. That's not the emphasis. That's not the focus. The focus is, because of his defeat, we are now enrolled in heaven. Satan has been bounced. He's out. He has no place there, but you do. Your name can be written in the book of life, so that you are already on the guest list. When you show up and Michael, the bouncer, is at the door, you're let in because your name is on the list, all because of the victory of Christ. So when we're told in places like the book of Colossians to set our hearts and our minds on the things above, what it's trying to do there is say, listen, you're already on the list. Your name is already there. You're as good as in heaven. So when you think about that reality and you set your heart on that reality, you're able to even now in this existence experience the peace and the joy and the presence of God internally and around you, no matter what's going on in this difficult time. So set your heart on that victory, set your mind on that victory to be able to experience some of its benefits even now. So rejoice in heaven, but woe to the earth. Woe to the earth. Therefore rejoice, verse 12, you heavens and you who dwell in them, but woe to the earth and the sea, because the devil has gone down to you. He is filled with fury because he knows that his time is short. There's victory in heaven. The angels rejoice after the battle. Jesus was born and rescued from the devouring mouth of the dragon. He was able to accomplish his mission of dying for our sins, and he rose again and ascended to the throne room of God. His earthly work made possible a heavenly victory, and now Satan has been booted out the door, but woe to the earth, because guess where he landed? He landed here. Now, this is the pastoral reason for this letter. This is the question and the answer to the question, why are things so bad still? If there's a victory, why are things so bad still? If Jesus was victorious over sin and death and Satan's been bounced and Jesus is Lord, not Caesar, why are things still so bad? Why is there still terrorism? Why are there still mass shootings? Why do my relatives keep dying? Why do Christians keep suffering? Why does sickness still sweep through and do devastation? Why is there still pain and evil and sorrow and sadness if Jesus is Lord? And this is why Paul writes this letter to say, look, you need to understand what's going on behind the scenes. Victory has been accomplished, but for a short time, for a limited time, Satan is still at work on earth. Satan is still doing his stuff. Because all this stuff that we go through sometimes, all the stuff we see in the world, it seems like the work of the dragon. And friends, it is. Whether it's his direct influence or if it's just an effect of his evil presence on this world, everything that is ungodly, everything that is unheavenly, everything that we won't see in heaven is a direct effect of him being bounced to earth. And so John writes saying, be encouraged. This is only for a limited amount of time. Satan is in his death throes. You know what death throes are? I was on an adventure with my friend Chris, who's in church today. And Chris is a hunter, and I am not, even though I wear a red plaid, right? But I love the outdoors, I love hiking and stuff, but I've never been into guns and shooting things and animals that can eat you or anything like that. That's never been my thing, but I just wanted to get out there, and he took me out on his quads, and we went on an adventure, and we were out way past Karameas and Ashinola Park and way beyond civilization and safety of any kind, and we were looking for this specific bear that he had seen the season before. He wanted to find this bear to see if it was still there. He was worried another hunter had killed it. It wasn't quite bear season, but we just wanted to go and kind of scout. So we were purposely trying to find bears, if you believe that, right? So we're out there, and of course, when we're looking for bears, Chris is telling me all these bear stories. Stories where he's encountered a bear. Stories that he's heard of other hunters who've encountered a bear. And story after story led me to be so confident in the fact that I was not going to be eaten by one. Of course not. All these stories were of people who did not get eaten by bears or attacked by them. No, these were crazy stories. But here's the best part. This is what he told me. I don't even think we were on the quads at this point, and only he had a gun, right? So we're walking around, and he says, yeah, you know, even if a grizzly bear charged you, and you shot it right in the heart, that bear has so much blood and adrenaline in its body, it can probably live for about 5 minutes before it dies. And this is what he said. That means he'd finish eating you before he died. Well, I think it's about time we head home. Those are the death throes. Woe to anyone who is in range of a dying grizzly bear. And woe to anyone who is on earth or in the sea who is in range of this furious and frustrated yet dying dragon. Later we will see what Satan's end destiny will be, but for now he has been bounced to earth and we are experiencing the tribulation that comes from his presence. So this is what John is saying to the churches. He's saying our suffering is not a sign of Satan's victory over us. Our suffering is actually a sign of his realization of defeat. And he is trying to do whatever he can in the meantime to continue to deceive and destroy and kill whoever he can with his limited time left. He cannot get the child, so he goes after what is most precious to the child. He goes after the woman. And he goes after her offspring. He goes after believers. He goes after the children of God. Next week, as we finish chapter 12, we'll learn more about how we overcome the dragon in the here and now. And we live victorious as conquerors over him today. But for now, I just want to give a couple points of conclusion. And the communion team is going to prepare. You guys can head into the foyer and get yourselves organized. But what we're going to do in a few minutes is we are going to participate in the signs of victory. Remember, a sign is something that points to a greater reality. So today we're going to act out this victory that Jesus accomplished through communion. But quickly, I want to give a couple points of application as the team gets ready. First of all, things are not as they seem. When you look around you, at the world around you, you need to recognize that there is more going on than your physical senses can perceive. There is a cosmic battle going on. There are things happening behind the scenes, many of them John reveals to us in his letter to the church. The victory of Christ assures heavenly salvation. And we're not always going to understand our suffering right now. We might wonder where God is in the pain, why Jesus has not come back, why he doesn't seem to be saving us from our particular situation. But because of what we know, we can have full confidence that what we're going through is only temporary. The dragon may be wreaking havoc, but his time is short. Whatever you face, it is not a sign of the victory of the enemy. It is a sign of his imminent defeat. No matter what you face, remember, victory is secured, and you are enrolled in heaven. As Winston Churchill once said, when you're going through hell, don't stop. The time is short. This is temporary. Secondly, maybe you want assurance of that today. You want to be assured that you're enrolled in heaven. You've experienced the lashing out of the dragon, the effects of evil because of his presence. Well, there's a victory that's been won for you. You just need to receive it. You just need to believe it. The dragon isn't Lord. Death isn't Lord. Sickness isn't Lord. Caesar isn't Lord. Politics aren't Lord. Fate isn't Lord. Whatever situation you're in isn't Lord. Jesus is Lord. Jesus is Lord. Romans 10:9 tells us, if you declare with your mouth Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. You will be saved. Declare him as your Lord, maybe for the first time today. Enter into that victory and you can join in heaven's celebration.